my assessment of what's happening today and maybe even some conjectures about the future and where the church is going. And in particular, the context of what we are seeing globally within Christianity as a whole. And I want to speak more specifically about the Reformed tradition as it applies to us. Let me begin with the quote from Philip Jenkins, who has been over the last at least two decades one of the leading Western historian scholars studying the shifts in global Christianity. He teaches at Penn State University. Philip Jenkins writes, "Over the past century, the center of gravity in the Christian world has shifted inexorably southward to Africa, to Asia, and Latin America. Already today, the largest Christian communities on the planet are to be found in Africa and Latin America," and this is my throw-in, and I would add Asia as well. So Jenkins is noting that there is this massive shift going on now in the world today in which the concentration of Christians no longer is in Western Europe and North America. It has shifted outside now, again, to South America, Latin America, Africa, and Asia as well. In that context, then, we can conclude that what we are seeing in this global shift is really the decline of Christianity in Europe. That's been charted very carefully already by many scholars. Massive secularism, post-Christian environment of Europe, no question, we are seeing and have seen that. But one could argue that America has resisted that, that we have seen even as early, or I should say as late as the 1980s, 60% of the American population still claiming to be born-again Christians. But when you put that in the wider context, we can see that that really does not mark an increase, but still a decrease in our understanding of global Christianity. Take, for example, this pie chart here. If you were to compare 1900s, and you'll see Europe, North America, represented by the blue, 65% of Christians living in Europe and North America, 18% in others, 17% in Asia, Africa, Latin America. Shift to 2011, this census data just from 3 years ago, and you can see the massive shift and difference. 60% now in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and only 35% in Europe and North America. And I think if you were to chart that 3 years out to our present day, those numbers in terms of outside the U.S. and Europe would increase, and that 35% is probably going down a couple percentage points even the last 3 years. Okay. Now, just by that type of statistical comparison, again, one could argue that what we are seeing is the decline then of Christianity in North America and Europe. The Pew Foundation did a study in which they concluded, quote, "The landscape survey confirms that the United States is on the verge of becoming a minority Protestant country." That means Protestants are going to be the minority religion in the U.S. very quickly, according to the Pew Foundation's survey. Now, if you think about it, you know, they're doing this massive survey, and they're speaking about Protestantism as broad as you can, as generic. All denominations, liberal, conservative, doesn't matter. Their survey is just anyone who identifies outside the Roman Catholic Church as Protestant. And after their survey, they're concluding, given the decline of numbers, Protestantism is going to be a minority religion. Now, if you think about that, and you think about within Protestantism, our tradition, for example, the Reformed tradition, that's a tiny sliver. And there's no question that if the overall trend is shrinking, decreasing, Reformed theology, Reformed tradition in America is doing the same thing. Now, again, many have pushed back on that survey and said no, but this whole young, restless reform movement, this new Calvinism movement is bucking that trend. What are we talking about here? Young, restless reform, new Calvinism movement. If you estimate by the size of churches that are involved in that movement, conference attendance from Together for the Gospel to Gospel Coalition that represents that movement, what are we talking about here? Conferences that have maybe 10,000 people at the most, churches that number somewhere, like take John Piper's church as the largest, you know, a few thousand at the most. Compare that statistic to what we are seeing in the U.S. right now, and I have the number here where they're tracking now every year, annual growth, 6% in Islam every year right now. 6%. We're not seeing anything like that in Protestantism. And the Young Leftist Reform Movement is not even adding probably a percentage to the growth of Protestantism in America. And Islam is moving at a rate of 6% annually in America. Okay? So again, when I look at that and I think it's a blip, it's a positive blip. I have a lot of appreciation for the new Calvinism, the Young Restless and Reform Movement, but I don't think it's putting a dent at all in the global trends that Philip Jenkins is pointing out. Okay, that's where we're headed. Now, let's zero in a little bit now. If we talk about, if we move from wider Protestantism and we move specifically to what's happening in the Reformed context here, let's do another simple comparison. This is in thousands. So right now, that's actually not an accurate number. This was done 3 years ago. The PCA now is recording that its membership is probably closer down, somewhere close to 300,000. Somewhere in the 300,000 to 310,000 range membership. Okay, and again, by all comparisons, if you're talking about conservative American Reformed Presbyterian denominations, PCA is the largest. Okay, so no offense, please, if you're in the OPC or the denominations out there. I just use PCA here because it's the largest in North America. One estimate, Reformed House Church networks in China, I know of one at least that numbers in the millions in terms of membership. Okay. Largest conservative Presbyterian denomination in Korea, Hapdong denomination, their records demonstrate 3 million members in their church in Korea. Okay. So if you just compare Reformed denominations across what's happening in these three illustrations, you can see what's happening now in terms of growth. Gustavo, remind me, your Presbyterian denomination in Brazil, how many members? 1 million members in Brazil. So again, I could throw that, I should throw that up on this chart too, to show another region in which a Reformed Presbyterian denomination outside the U.S. triples the size of our largest conservative Reformed denomination in the U.S. right now. That's pretty amazing as part of these global shifts. Which tells me, in many cases, let me do one more comparison just to take it a little bit closer to home for us here. Again, if we were to compare Reformed seminaries here, WTS, if we add all our part-time students and everyone who's kind of on the list, we're probably somewhere in 550 or so total students. RTS, if you add up all their campuses, they're not five anymore, they're over six now. And again, I did this 3 years ago. You know, they're numbering somewhere in the 1300s, probably even larger by today, 1400 or so, if you add up all of their students together. Chungshin Seminary in Korea, over close to 1800, probably around 1700 students on their campus there. I visited that campus. It's pretty amazing to see the vibrancy, the numbers there, and they have to actually cap enrollment. And from what I understand, there are government restrictions by their Department of Education that caps enrollment at their school. So imagine if they didn't have that, they would probably be twice that size as a Reformed seminary in Korea. So again, you can see the differences just both in terms of denominations and both in terms of seminaries. Now, on top of that, note, when I say that, you know, their numbers are capped by the Department of Education in South Korea. We are trending now, ATS reports from the Association of Theological Schools is trending now decrease enrollment across the board in all seminaries in the United States, including Reform seminaries. Okay, so that number is actually, these numbers are dwindling on the bottom two charts right now, where we're seeing growth on the other end in terms of global seminaries that are moving. Again, Gustavo, remind me, your seminary in Brazil, roughly, do you know how big is the student body there?
We have eight denominational seminaries.
Mm-hmm. There will be approximately 150 students. Per seminary, yeah. So eight like that. So you've got over 1,000, potentially 1,000 students in those eight seminaries as well. And this is in Brazil. So you get a sense then of what's happening in terms of global shifts, even in the Reformed context here, which pushes us, I think, to think very carefully about what the Reformed tradition is going to look like moving into the future when you, studying here at Westminster, if you don't already feel it, you are the minority and a shrinking minority here in North America. It's very fascinating to see. We at Westminster, we've actually bucked this declining trend in American seminaries. Our numbers have held steady pretty much over the last 4 or 5 years when everybody else is taking a nosedive. But as we looked at our data more carefully, the reason we've held steady is because we have seen an increase in international students here at Westminster, which again tells me that this is what's happening. It's very difficult to recruit a domestic student now because that constituency is shrinking as Christianity and Protestantism is shrinking in North America, but international students still have great interest in studying at theological seminaries, given the growth of their churches and the need for theological education there as well. And so we've seen the international side continue to grow here at Westminster, even though the overall trend is for seminaries now to be experiencing declining enrollment. Okay. Questions up to this point, I'm curious, are these numbers shocking to you? You kind of knew about that already? Are you surprised? I'm really curious to see what your reaction is. Sure.
Do you know if that's more prevalent among liberal or mainline?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's an overall average, but there's no question the schools that are leading the way are mainline liberal seminaries with declining enrollment. I mean, it has reached the point where a number of mainline seminaries have sold property and done things to downsize. Union Seminary up in New York, their property has been for sale for many years now. They've been trying to downsize. I mean, it is. Yeah, we toyed with the idea, what would it be like to move Westminster up there? Because they have faculty housing, student housing, and you're talking about in Manhattan here, so this is not, cheap property there. But they're at the heart. They're right by Columbia University in the upper west of Manhattan. And they're trying to sell that property. They can't sustain themselves anymore up there. That's the liberal schools in particular are feeling this. But the interesting thing about the statistics they're showing us, the conservative schools are not immune to this. We are seeing that happening too. Just not at the same rate, but it's happening as well. So much so that Ligon Duncan, who is the new chancellor of RTS, just inaugurated this past year. I was told by faculty members there when he came into that office, the first thing he did was invite Al Mohler, president of Southern Seminary, down and to give them kind of an assessment of where seminary education is going in the United States. And basically he told them, get ready for a depression, that we're going to see declining enrollment, shrinking donor pool, all of that, and you better get ready for it. And so what I've been hearing that Southern Seminary right now is doing everything to try to, all the deferred maintenance of their building, they have a pretty nice campus, very old campus, lots of buildings. They're trying to get all that up and taken care of so that you don't have these looming bills coming because you got to repair a roof or tear. I mean, give you an example of what we're talking about in costs. If you look at the front of Machen Hall right here, if you look very carefully, some of you may have been around at the time, I think most of you were not, you can see that there's actually a difference in the stonework there, right? If you go out and look, there's some newer stone and there's some older stones there, and it doesn't quite look like it matches. About 5 years ago, we realized that the wood in between those stones and the walls of Machen was deteriorating, and it was becoming such a hazard that we were worried those stones were going to fall inward on somebody's office there. And so basically, we had to have someone come and, like a jigsaw puzzle, take down all the stones in the front of Machen, clean them, repair the wall on the inside, and then they put it back up like a big jigsaw puzzle. That was over $500,000 project, just those stones in the front. So that just gives you an idea of, what deferred maintenance on buildings costs for seminaries, particularly if you have a beautiful old stone building like this. And so Al Mohler is saying, get all your buildings ready because you don't want to be spending that kind of money later. And push everything into endowment, because traditionally most of our seminaries, particularly evangelical seminaries, were dependent on your money to survive. Tuition dollars is huge. So if enrollment declines, then you can't count on tuition dollars to continue to support you. get your endowments as strong as possible so that the interest earned off those endowments will be able to supply your operating costs year to year. I mean, this is Al Mohler, head of the flagship seminary in the Southern Baptist Convention, which is still the largest evangelical Protestant denomination, saying he's getting ready for a depression in seminaries. That means all of us who are much smaller, who don't have a big constituency as he does. I mean, this is a guy, when he's on CNN or whatever, and he says, come support us, tons of Southern Baptists write checks into Southern Seminary and have kept them alive. He's saying, get ready to tighten the belt. That means the rest of us have to be ready as well. Yeah. Other questions just on the statistical data here so far?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm not even convinced, if I were to describe it this way, I would say that what Jenkins is noticing, you know, if he says the next last century we've seen the shift. Well, if you count back 100 years from what he's talking about, yes, it began with Western missionaries going out that started. And 100 years ago was the tail end of the great Protestant mission century movement of all the great missionaries that often Protestants point to that went to Africa and Asia and South America. And in many ways, we could say the seeds they laid, this is the fruit of. But the growth, much of the growth, I would argue, historically, has happened with some influence from the West, but not entirely. I'll give you one stark, but I think, example that illustrates this. You know, after World War II, Communist Revolution in China, all the missionaries are kicked out. Mao Zedong kicks them all out. They're all out. No Western influence. Shuts his doors to the West. China closes off. This is that period of time, and many of you may know Dr. Gaffin, Richard Gaffin, our emeritus professor of systematic theology. He was born in Beijing. His father, missionary there, left as a result of what happened with the Communist Revolution, or else probably he would have stayed there and continued as a missionary there. And, you know, Dr. Gaffin was born in China, but his father leaves as a result of that. The doors close, and they don't reopen until Nixon goes on his diplomatic mission to China and is able to negotiate and reopen some access to China from the West. For myself, 1970s and 80s, growing up in a Chinese-American church here in the U.S., we were always told, pray for the church in China. We know there's persecution going on, but we had no idea what was happening. Bits and pieces, little news would come out. I had no idea what was happening in the church in China. Lo and behold, to come to the 80s and 90s and to realize that instead of the intention of communism to get rid of religion and Christianity, it flourished. It grew. It grew to an extent that the numbers are staggering. And that was in a country that was closed to the West for many years. And yet Christianity continues to grow there. So that's just one illustration, I think, of, you know, Western influence begins Christianity, but the growth is not necessarily attributed to continual Western influence. Yeah.
Well, one could argue that that would be another indication of the success,
yeah,
of missionary efforts, oh, yeah, throughout America.
Yeah. In planting the seeds. Yeah. Same for Korea. If you look at the history of Korea, 100 years ago as well, Presbyterian missionaries there, Korea goes under Japanese occupation. Missionaries are all kicked out. Indigenous Korean Christian movement survives and grows. And today they're one of the strongest in terms of overall Christian population in that country today. Again, similar story. An indigenous church that grows and continues to move in that way. I'm curious, Gustavo, if you want to keep picking on, because I know that South America is something that we're observing as well, too. Historically, Presbyterianism arrives in Brazil around what time?
1859.
That's the century of Protestant mission work going on. And again, seeds laid, and now you have Gustavo's own denomination of 1 million Reformed Presbyterians in Brazil. Similar story. Yeah. Question, Matt?
I was wondering if you could talk about in some of these areas what the proportions are compared to in America between Reformed and other denominations. Because I know the Pentecostal churches are huge.
Exactly. Yeah. So if we were to, I began with the big comparison of Protestantism in the West versus Protestantism outside of the West. And overall Protestantism is declining in the West. It's growing everywhere else. And then I zeroed in on Reformed tradition, but you're right. Take Korea, for example. No question, they have a denomination that a couple million members in the Reformed Presbyterian denomination. But compare that to, for instance, some of their other churches. Yoido Full Gospel Church, which is the largest church in the world, is a Pentecostal church. It's Protestant, so it's part of that great Protestant growth. So I don't want to give the impression, that the Reformed Church is the dominant church outside of the U.S., but its proportions compared to the U.S. are staggering. But likewise, they have other denominations that would be even larger. Yeah. Even in China, there's a variety, from my understanding, there's a variety of theological traditions in China. Reformed theology is one. There are others. What we're beginning to discover, and there's more work that needs to be done, is that probably out of all the places we're seeing Reformed theology gaining momentum like it hasn't in other countries and in other places in China right now. There is great interest on multiple levels in terms of Reformed theological thinking in China. So that proportion there may be a little bit different where the Reformed is a little bit larger. But yeah, there's no question that it would still be, by and large, more of a minority in other parts of the world, but still growing as the overall trend is growing. Those statistics aren't based on overall population proportions. They're based on simply looking at denominational membership and adding that up. So one could make the argument, when you've got a much larger population, let's say in China compared to the U.S., you should see a proportional difference in Christianity there as well. That's a fair argument. But I still think what's interesting is to see, even in terms of that proportionality of overall population, the decrease in Europe, let's just say, we all account for the overall population difference, but the percentage of Christians still within that population is shrinking in Europe where it's growing in other parts of the world. So there's still some comparison points. But at the same time, it is very much worth noting what I'm describing. I'm looking at the Reformed tradition, but I don't want to give you the impression that this is the dominant tradition outside the U.S. Take, for example, again, another experience that I've had and traveling to Indonesia a number of times now, and Gray's from Indonesia, and I think Gray will confirm, Reform in terms of Protestantism in Indonesia, Reform is still pretty small, right? It would be probably a more Pentecostal movement that is larger there in Indonesia as well. Now, that's not to say, again, when we talk about size-wise, yes, the Reform movement in Indonesia compared to wider Protestant numbers is pretty small overall. Yet at the same time, you look at Stephen Tong's church in Indonesia, I think they're averaging a few thousand people there on a Sunday in a Muslim country. We don't even have a church in Philadelphia that big. That's a Reformed Presbyterian church. Largest would be probably like 10th Presbyterian Church or Proclamation Presbyterian Church. Both of them right now are struggling to get 1,000 people on a Sunday. So again, you can see the differences in terms of size, even taking into account context in terms of overall population. And more surprising, I think, for my own observations is that, this is a Reformed movement in Indonesia where the dominant religion by far is Islam. And yet we see this growth happening there. We're not even talking 6% growth of Islam. I mean, do you know the numbers, Gray? Would you say, what's the estimate population? How large is Islam in Indonesia, if you were to take a guess in terms of population size?
So 90% of
90%. 90% of the population is Muslim. You know. Yeah, yeah. But would identify themselves as Muslim, 90% of the population. Wow. Yeah. So again, you see there's a context difference, yet at the same time, we're seeing this growth happening. Any other comments up to this point so far? In my opinion, then, this becomes the challenge. It's the challenge for the church, and we've been focusing so much on the church in America. It becomes the challenge for the church in America to think now strategically and globally about what gospel ministry will look like in the next century. And I dare say for many of you leaving here from Westminster, I really pray, my great hope is that you would think along these lines as to what God would send you to do when you graduate from Westminster. Now, let me be very clear. For those of you who God may call to pastor churches in America, yes, we need you still. And in many ways, I would say we need good pastors in America probably today more than ever. Given the secularization that is happening, given the movements that we are seeing in our culture, then even someone as so culturally engaged as Tim Keller is saying now, this kind of Protestant hegemony that we've all lived under here in America, it's gone. That's gone now. And we will be faced in America with many significant challenges to our faith as the culture has shifted. At the same time, I think, we must keep our eyes open to recognize what is happening in the world and how we might participate in that moving forward. For some of you, it's to go. The Lord may take you away from Glenside, Pennsylvania, and send you to someplace outside of the U.S. to labor amongst those who desperately need theological education. At the same time, if I can put it in the framework of revivalism, at the same time, we are seeing the Spirit move in remarkable ways. And would you be willing to go? And let me be clear here. The world's not that big a place anymore. So when I say go, it's not like the 19th century in which you read these accounts of these missionaries who leave their homes and it's like, kiss their family goodbye, I'll see you in heaven because I don't know where I'm going and I don't know if I'll ever be back. The world's not like that anymore. And the ability to move and travel and relocate back and forth is so easy. I mean, okay, now I'm showing you my age. When I was an undergraduate, I didn't even have an email account. I mean, this was just starting this stuff. And I remember getting on a plane and going to Scotland for the first time to do my graduate study work. And I was like, this isn't so bad. And I was really afraid because I'd never been outside the U.S. That was my first time, actually. And I thought, in a half a day's travel, 8-9 hours, I could be home. You know, if there was an emergency, if my father got sick or something happened back home, I can jump on a plane and I'll be home in half a day. And on top of that, I was like, what did graduate students do before email? How would they, you know, you send a letter home and it takes weeks for it to come back. And here I'm shooting emails back and forth with my family and keeping in connection with everyone and everything that's going on back there. I know for many of you here younger than me, you're probably thinking like, what kind of world were you living in? That's we are so globally connected. And at the same time, I would say on top of that, and this is where globalization has been a positive contributor, I think, to what we could see in ministry. You will be surprised that as you travel the world, and I do encourage you to go, you'll be surprised at how comfortable you actually are in different parts of the world. That globalization has impacted particularly the major cities across the world, that you could travel to these cities, and I don't think you would actually feel very uncomfortable. You would see a Starbucks on every corner. You will see McDonald's. You will see all the brands and things that you're so familiar with. And globalization has moved in that direction now in which we're not so separate, even culturally. And that's an advantage now for what we're seeing in terms of migration patterns going back and forth, back and forth. I have been astounded by the number of Korean-American pastors, more a kind of half generation older than me, in their late 40s and early 50s. I can name a half a dozen who have been called back to Korea to be senior ministers of churches in Korea. That's a that's amazing. That's a reverse immigration pattern that is going on now, in which in the past, Koreans were coming to the U.S. to immigrate, better opportunity for their children and other advantages here. And now we're seeing, as a generation is shifting of senior ministers in these large, very significant churches in Korea, as we've seen this growth, they're calling Korean-American pastors back to serve as pastors in these churches. This kind of migration pattern tells me some of you may not be here in the U.S. God may call you to go someplace else and to have a significant impact in those places, because the world just isn't so big anymore. The question I have as you think about this is, how big are you willing to dream? Where's your vision for the kingdom and your part in it? To me, that's something that I hope will start here at Westminster. That you're not just sitting here learning facts and details about exegesis, about systematic theology, apologetics, church history, but that you have a time to sit and talk, particularly with your brothers and sisters as you're staying, with to think, what am I going to do after I leave Westminster? Where's God going to take us? And start laying plans now to think about. The story goes that when Jonathan Chow, who is a big part of the impact of the growth of the church in China through his ministry there, that if you talked to him when he was a student here, he was dreaming all the time. He wanted to see a Chinese Reformed seminary. He planted three of them in his career. He wanted to dream about what the church would look like and the impact in China. And he did all that dreaming here. And I remember talking to Bill Crispin about this, who has been a significant church planter in the Philadelphia area. And Bill Crispin told me that Jonathan Chow, to make some extra money, he was a poor student here, he would cut other students' hair. And he said, if you sat down and he's cutting your hair, he's going to hold you there for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, talking about his dreams, sharing with you, getting you excited about what he's thinking about doing. And my real challenge is, what is God putting on your heart to think about, big or small? But start laying those plans now. Start thinking about that now, because you'll be amazed at what God does and the doors that he opens. Now, for some of you, I know some of you are graduating this, others you may be staying around. There is a unique opportunity right now in which we've had a donor who's given a pretty significant amount of funding, because this donor cares about missions and wants Westminster students to experience that. So Dr. Loback has a fund right now. We're taking the application. Do you want to go someplace in the world? Your travel will be paid for. Go and see. Go and see what is happening. There is nothing in terms of what can impact you. Hearing me talk about these statistics, hearing me talk about this group, that's one thing. But for you to actually go and see it, that could have a significant impact on your life and your thinking. We have the means to send you right now. We have the funding. So finance is not an issue. I know many of you, it is difficult financially for you as you're struggling to make it through Westminster. But on this one, I want to say, if you have interest to go and see, sign up. We'll send you. Because there's nothing, my first trip, the first time I took Dr. Tipton to Indonesia, I wanted him to see. I can joke about this because Dr. Tipton and I are good friends. We go all the way back to Westminster, California together. And I'm always like, you're this high school football jock from Amarillo. You need to go see the world a little bit. And I took him with me to Indonesia for the first time. And he taught there. And he said to me, he said, Jeff, that was a life-changing experience. Life-changing. To see the hunger and desire to learn, to see what God is doing. And we were there on an Easter Sunday going to preach at the church, and there were security guards at the church with those kinds of mirrors that you look under the car for bombs, looking, we're sitting there going, well, what's going on here? And Dr. Tipton admitted to me, he said, I got a call from my mom and my wife back in the U.S., and they're really worried. In fact, his mother told him, maybe you shouldn't go on this trip, because she's heard about all the radical Islam and stuff going on. She's like, yeah. And it was interesting. This was like one of the most encouraging comments I ever heard from him. He said, I told my mom, in God's hands, I'm as safe as in my bed at home as I am in Jakarta, Indonesia. I mean, you talk about a Calvinist theology and faith hitting the ground. He's like, I'm as safe in God's hands and my bed at home as I am here in Jakarta. He wasn't scared. He wasn't scared. But go and see. Go and see what God is doing. And again, we have the ability to send you, so I do want to encourage you to take advantage of that and to see what's happening in the world. As we see these global shifts happening, as we see this movement going on, the question will be, what do we do in the West? And I've had a lot of people ask me that. And I would leave you with a couple of comments about that. First, I'm looking around this room right now, and I'm seeing that over half of the students in this room, I would say, have had multicultural experiences. In other words, you know what it's like to live and experience two different cultures, at least two, if not more. That is a huge advantage. A huge advantage in the global world to understand people who are different than you culturally, and yet at the same time to be able to relate and build bridges as we partner together in moving forward. Now, for myself, just as an example, you know, growing up in America here as an Asian American, you almost have this mindset of understanding you're living in two worlds all the time. When my Caucasian friends invite me over to their house, I have no problem taking a steak knife and a fork and eating a nice piece of steak with them. If I go to an Asian friend's house, I have no problem taking my shoes off and eating with chopsticks. I don't even think about it. It just, that's the world that I live in. And it's not even a second thought that, okay, we do something different here and we do something different over here. And the ability to do that brings a comfort level to people that opens bridges and opportunities. And if you've lived that kind of bicultural, multicultural experience, that is a huge advantage for you in the global world. Just think about it right now. If you were in the business world, you know, if you were coming out of an MBA program instead of an MDiv program right now, and you were bilingual, you know the job opportunities that are open for you? The business world knows this. If you can speak Mandarin or Korean, you're going to get snatched up by a major company very, very quickly because they recognize the global advantages of that. We have those same advantages in ministry. Those same opportunities are there as well. At the same time, for those of you who the Lord may be saying, you know, stay here, pastor a church here in America. There is work to do here still. I would encourage you very much to think about the fact that the world comes to us too. It's not just that we have to go out. The migration patterns back and forth are such that wherever the Lord puts you in the U.S. to minister, I have no doubt that you will see the world come to your doorstep. You know, from what I understand, even Dr. Truman's church, is that right, Charles? You guys have a Portuguese service now as well at their church? Gustavo's a part of that. Imagine doing that at your church, of being able to reach those communities around you as we see immigration patterns still going on and different people from all over the world still coming to the U.S. That's a huge opportunity. Because as they come, it's not like the old immigration patterns like my parents' generation, the generation before, where you come and you stay in the U.S. because this is kind of the Chinese call the gold mountain. This is where you want to come to make your success. That's not the case anymore. People are going back and forth all over now. And that neighbor or that community that may come around your church, they may be sending people back to their home country all the time. And you have an opportunity to impact them with the gospel as they go back and forth. Will you take that opportunity? Will you think that way so that as you go into perhaps a pastoral ministry in a church, you're not just thinking about that congregation that's before you, you're thinking about what are the opportunities around that we can extend and support what is happening globally? I think that's very, very important to think about. At the same time, I would say, remember Westminster. Like it or not, There has been an amazing blessing that the Lord has given Westminster as a global seminary. We have graduates all over the world. And there's a brand to that that continues to move forward in which we need to think about how to deliver theological education in the 21st century. And some of you could help support us in that, to think through that, to work with us as we think about that, because this has to change. We cannot be concerned just with the 400 or so full-time students that come to this campus every year. We have to think about how to extend outward, because there are so many people who can't afford or for other logistical reasons aren't able to come to this campus. And yet at the same time, they have need for theological education probably more so than some of our communities here in the U.S. And right now, we are strategizing and thinking, what does that look like? What does that look like to have that opportunity? One potential blessing that I would ask you to pray for us about is we do have some international donors who are saying, well, one of the things that you guys need that would really help you, and it's kind of a no-brainer, is you need some housing over here. I mean, how difficult is it? I would imagine for even you domestic students who have moved here from out of town, it wasn't easy probably to go and look and try to figure out which apartment and then sign a lease and do all of that to figure out how to settle yourselves before you even started studying here. Imagine the difficulty for an international student to come and figure all that out. We need housing here. We need to provide housing that would allow students to come and make it much easier for their transition here to Philadelphia. And we're very thankful because we have interest right now from some who want to come by us and partner with us in that way. Pray for us, because these are the kinds of things we have to think about now as Westminster looks into the future, as we look at what's happening in the church, and as we look at the resources God has given us. At the same time, and this is probably one of the most, I think, most significant things that Westminster can do. You know, there is a pattern going on that has troubled American seminaries for quite some time. And this is a pattern of which international students come, and then they never go home. And I've sat in many meetings with deans from other schools who have struggled with this issue, because we want to support the international church, we want to support international students, but we also see this pattern where sometimes they come to the great disappointment of people back home, they just don't go back home. And there are a host of reasons for that, and I'm not saying that they're all bad reasons, but there's a host of reasons why someone would do that, but we're thinking, well, how do we encourage? Because we don't want them just all to come and stay in the United States. At the same time, we realize that in that context there, those churches that used to send students are starting to say, well, maybe that's not the pattern. Maybe we shouldn't send students to do their MDivs in the U.S. And there's been a lot of concentrated effort to build MDiv curriculum in their home countries and then to send their students to places like Westminster to do THM and PhD work, so that they'll be the teachers for the next generation, and that will strengthen their MDiv programs. In the meantime, the stopgap, because it takes time to train a teacher, is that you ask any Westminster professor here how many invitations they get internationally to go and teach all over. I tell our faculty, you want to go anywhere in the world, I can get you an invitation to go teach. But usually what happens is you go, students who are eager and desire to learn, but they don't speak English. And so you have to have a translator. And let me tell you, if you don't have a good translator, the whole project is in vain. It has to be someone who's very, very capable, both in terms of the language acquisition, both languages, but also the theological vocabulary that a Westminster professor needs in order for their concepts and understandings to be translated into another language. That's a tough task. That's a difficult task. And I have so much respect for so many of the students who are willing to sit through even that type of teaching because they're so desiring and eager to learn. Which tells me again, you know, if you have a bilingual ability or you have an interest, because some of you I think are very good with languages, even though you may not have learned a particular language, but you have the ability to acquire languages. Invest in that. Invest in that, because the next generation moving forward needs, I want to see faculty members raised up in the Reformed tradition out of Westminster who would be able to teach in the languages that people need to learn in without the need, cumbersome process of translation. You know, my Mandarin is very simple conversational Mandarin. That's it. Yeah, and most, you know, Chinese students who come to Westminster, they're actually even surprised that I can speak some Mandarin. They're actually shocked because at one point, a couple years ago, there were two Chinese students in the front and listening to my lecture, and I saw this one student, he had a real puzzled face. He leaned over to his friend in Chinese and said to him, "That doesn't make any sense. Do you understand what he's saying?" And I said to him in English, "Well, let me explain it to you again." And he was shocked. He was like, "You understood what I said there." That gives me a little bit of access, because when I travel to Asia, I can actually have just simple conversations with you. But I can't teach. I can't preach. I don't have the vocabulary. And it is a barrier that I can't cross right now. And so if you have those abilities, or if you know that the Lord has gifted you with the abilities to learn languages easily, take advantage of that. Take advantage of that. That is a gift. And that's going to be much needed. And so I would encourage you, if you're able to do that, if you have that language ability and you have that type of interest, think about further studies after the MDiv. Think about THM PhD work, because that's going to be a huge need. Theological education with teachers, faculty members in the future. We need that as well. I hope then, just in terms of our short discussion here, that that's sparked some thoughts in your mind, and I'm happy to continue to talk with you as you think through that, set up times to meet with you to talk, because I do think if you don't leave this place with some vision, some idea of what the Lord has for you, then I've not done my job as a teacher at a seminary. If all I'm doing here is communicating to you facts and details of history, you can get that anywhere. My desire is to say, look at what God has done in the church in the past. Look what he's doing now. And dream about what could happen in the future. And so that's my encouragement as you think through this. But any last thoughts or questions for today?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. The hunger is amazing. And that hunger is so strong that they'll sit through cumbersome translated lectures because they want to learn. They really, and that's exciting. If you see that, that is tremendous. That is absolutely tremendous to see. Other thoughts? Well, again, as you continue to prepare yourself, particularly for the final exam in this class, don't hesitate to shoot me emails if questions come up, even as you're working on your papers as well. So I'll be praying for you as you complete those assignments to the end of the semester and beyond, to see what the Lord takes you to do as you leave Westminster. So thank you. It's been a good semester with all of you.